100 days on the place, yeah, man. It's a kick it, you know. That's right.
Yeah, me rolling and rock it to the beat, and me love the sound.
Oh, Chess, you can mess with the sound. Better grab your girl, your posse, and gather round.
Yeah, me rolling and bobbing and going like a mad man. Oh, the man got the studio for 19 or long, so me say.
Hey, 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 Digital Sister back. How are you? I hope everybody's fine. I'm kind of sad to hear of all the events going on in the Middle East because I had some listeners in Haifa who were downloading the podcast. And let's just send out our best wishes for everyone over there who's going through a very difficult time and hope that it can be resolved peacefully somehow so that, you know, my fans can continue to download in Haifa. So we're praying for you, and we hope that a diplomatic solution can come about. But let's get right into some news first, and then we'll get into our fun stuff a little bit later in the podcast. Now, check this out. Seems like CBS is really rolling out the guns for Katie Couric. They sent her on a 6-city listening tour to find out what viewers like and don't like about the CBS Evening News. I just think that's pretty interesting that they're really going all out for her. It seems to be a bit of a public relations tour, and she's mixing in some cancer fundraising because, you know, her husband and her sister both died of cancer. But she's doing a little bit of both as she greets anchor teams and affiliate members in Tampa, St. Petersburg, Dallas, Minneapolis, Denver, San Diego, and San Francisco. I just find it very interesting that they're really doing this for her, and as if she's going to come out with some great information that CBS News is going to really, you know, change the format and really, you know, make it something different than it has been for many, many years. But it will be very interesting to see, A, will the public accept her even after this goodwill publicity tour, or will people be kind of turned off by the whole situation? I mean, really, I don't recall CBS doing a big roadshow when Dan Rather took over the anchor seat from Walter Cronkite some 24 years ago. Oh, that's right. Gee, Dan did work at CBS for all those years, so they didn't have to do that. But nevertheless, they still didn't do anything like that for him to find out if there was something, you know, new or different that they could do since he was taking over from Walter Cronkite. So I kind of wonder if this whole thing with Katie, it's either going to work out very well or it's going to be a very serious flop. And it will be just interesting to see if she can really pull off anchoring the CBS News, or, as I talked about in previous podcasts, with Ed Bradley kind of slowing down, Dan Rather left abruptly. I'm sure there's other people who are kind of, you know, wondering what she's going to do, or is the way the network is going overboard for her going to impact what I do. So it's going to be interesting to see if this public relations tour does what the CBS network news thinks it's going to do, or if it's really going to backfire and, you know, turn people off from her. So, you know, we'll just have to wait and see. But I just thought it was interesting that they're really going all out for her. And it seems from some of the things we hear in the news that some of the people who've been there a long time are being somewhat slighted and not really given maybe the opportunity to do more. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, exactly what happens with that. Interestingly enough, we see that about some very influential black ministers quit the Katrina Clinton Bush panel fund because they were charged with being an advisory committee for the Bush and Clinton Katrina fund to disperse money to churches destroyed by Hurricane Katrina. Now, it seems as though 4 out of the 9 board members confirm their resignations. And this includes some pretty heavy hitters. Bishop T.D. Jakes, who's a prominent Dallas megachurch pastor, and the Reverend William H. Gray III, former president of the United Negro College Fund. He also resigned. And they also said they got the resignation from Reverend William Shaw, who's the president of the National Baptist Convention, which is the largest convention of black Baptist churches in the country. And there's some incredible amount of membership. But in any event, it's interesting that they decided that they would all quit the panel. And really the reason that they gave was that the fund, which was started by former President George H.W. Bush and former President Bill Clinton, that have raised some $125 million, of which approximately $20 million was going to be earmarked for rebuilding faith-based organizations along the Gulf Coast. And they were charged as part of the advisory committee to determine which churches, synagogues, or mosques were in the greatest need. But it turns out that many of the advisory members are saying that their advice was ignored by the people who ran the fund in Washington. It seems as though they were going to make around 500 awards, each for about $35,000. But apparently there were fewer applications coming in than they initially thought would come in. So they figured that would mean that they could increase the amount of the grant from $35,000 to, say, $100,000 and, you know, increase that money, but perhaps give it to a smaller number of institutions. But there were many disagreements and many conflicts and things like that. But Jakes and Gray said the last straw was the fund's decision to cut checks to 38 houses of worship, each for about $35,000, and without first conducting an audit to ensure that the church exists. Basically, another member said, who also resigned, an imam, I can't say his name, Benzerati, I think that's it, and please forgive me if I'm pronouncing it wrong, but he basically felt that Washington wanted the advisory committee to rubber stamp their decisions. So, I don't know, it's kind of interesting to me that here we have many, many very powerful, pastors of faith who've built, you know, mega churches and have done great things. And so I just found it kind of interesting that they would, you know, quit over something like that. I wonder why they decided not to stay and perhaps work out something that would ensure that perhaps there was some kind of audit. But I guess it's probably a little bit of sour grapes, because you probably have a bunch of incredible egos there coming around the table. They're used to being leaders in their own right, in their own congregations, in their own churches, and they're probably not really used to, another, let's say, manager of the fund kind of telling them what to do, or maybe not exactly taking every bit of advice that was suggested. So I wonder why they quit and decided to go that route versus staying with the advisory committee to ensure that the money raised, in fact, at least goes to a portion of African-American churches, Jewish synagogues, or some Islamic mosques. I mean, just to be sure that the money is distributed as fairly as possible, because what I suspect is if they're rubber stamping and wanting the advisory committee to rubber stamp their funding decisions, then perhaps maybe the money wasn't really going to a diverse group of churches and other religious organizations. Maybe it's just going to, you know, a particular type of group. So I wish they hadn't quit. I wish they had were able to stay around and kind of ensure that, the money goes where they say it goes. Because without them being there, there isn't going to be any, voice of conscience to oversee to the fund managers where the money should go. You know, maybe it's needed in some of the lower Ninth Ward areas, which were really hard hit, but because the advisory panel's no longer there, you know, maybe the money won't get there. But in any event, I kind of wish they had stayed and worked out their differences. Sometimes it's not always good to quit. You know, maybe you do after you've exhausted all possibilities, but it just didn't sound like to me that they had done that. It sounds to me like there's probably some egos that are getting in the way, and, you know, some control issues, and, you know, if I can't control it, if I can't have my voice heard, I'll just quit. So in any event, I hope they work out something to make sure that people get the money and the religious organizations get the money that was raised. Let's see. It seems as though there's something in the paper again about how Republicans are coming up short in their effort to reach out to African-American voters. I don't think it's a surprise, and even people who are Republicans who are black, like J.C. Watts, who's a former congressman from Oklahoma, I mean, he's basically said he doesn't think it's in the DNA of our party to get it done. And that makes me wonder, well, if you feel like that, then, you know, why are you still a card-carrying member member of the Republican Party? But in any event, that's another discussion. But, you know, what I think is that the party doesn't get it. You can't reach out to a particular group and then kind of poo-poo legislation that may be beneficial to them, which I'm talking about is the Voting Rights Act. You can't say you want to reach out and help, but then you drop the ball with the Katrina evacuation. You know, you can't say you're reaching out and you want to be inclusive if, in fact, that just isn't the case. So I think what's happening is the Republican Party keeps stepping on their own toes, and, you know, there's probably too many people with the same type of mindset, and it's going to be difficult for them to step out of that and really do something different. But anyway, I just thought it was interesting that the New York Times would devote, it's a political memo, would devote some half a page really to that issue. I mean, it's really no surprise. It's really kind of a no-brainer. But let's switch gears and get into our entertainment stuff. I've covered the serious stuff. Now, check this out. I was watching BET, catching up on my hip-hop, when this video came on. I can't remember the name of the artist or the song. But what I do remember is watching a video vixen hugging and caressing the front tire of this car. And as the rapper sang about how fly he was and his ride was and all that, the vixen was all but screwing the car and the tire. I just couldn't believe it. I was really shocked and I was stunned. But I think what really got me was seeing the video vixen sitting astride a spinning rim. Yes, she was sitting astride the rim with the rim between her legs. And I thought, man, this is like, I just couldn't believe it. It just really shocked me. It took the whole vixen ornament thing to a whole nother level. She was the car groupie, and the car, and to some degree, the rapper was basically, you know, incidental to some degree. But the rapper and the car were really the main attraction. Not the chick, not the vixen. It was all about the car. It was all about the rim. So I thought, man, I have never seen anything like that, but I certainly had to talk about it in the podcast. And like I said before, I can't remember the artist. I can't remember the name of the song, but what stuck out were those images. So I thought, that's pretty interesting. But I don't think that's what the label had in mind. I'm thinking they would prefer that you remember the rapper and the song. But let's look at what's happening with album sales, because apparently the digital revolution, which includes ringtones, streaming, online music subscriptions, are really just sending digital track downloads out of the stratosphere. And it seems as though albums, as we know them, are kind of dying a very slow death. Now let's think about this. consumers bought some 270.6 million albums, compared with 282.6 million albums at the same point in 2005 and 317.7 million in 2004. But fans downloaded some 280.9 million digital tracks in the first half of 2006 versus 158 million last year and 55 million in 2004. And really what's taking over this market is the fact that people are downloading single songs, and that is where the market is. People aren't really necessarily downloading albums. To some degree they are, but they're really more in tune with just downloading one particular track. And I think that's like pretty interesting. And so what's happening is a lot of the labels are kind of having to redefine how they market things, because the old way of doing things just isn't going to work today. You know, and a lot of the rappers know that secret. That's why they do their mixtapes and put a couple of cuts on the mixtape. But I thought, man, pretty interesting how the digital world is really, really taking over. And we have a group called Field Mob. They're new signees on Ludacris's Disturbing the Peace label. And what they did was they released their So What single, and then the download added snippets of songs off the album. So that's how they're getting promotion of their album. And there's a picture of them. They're a little different because they're wearing suits. You know, they're not all wrapped up in the bling bling and the pants hanging behind their pants and the gold medallions. But they're very much in business suits, and, you know, they're taking advantage of the new digital age and getting their music across. So kudos to them. Check this out. There's this whole next big bling thing in publishing called Hip Hop Fiction. It's stories of gangster life. And it's a new segment, it's a new niche in the publishing, which apparently is, you know, taking and catching the eye of a lot of publishing houses. Now let's see who this appeals to. It appeals to young black urban Americans who are between the ages of 18 and 35 who are interested in rap music and street life. Hip-hop literature is also known as gangsta lit, ghetto fiction, street lit, hip-hop novels, street life novels, hip-hop lit, blaxploitation novels, and urban pulp fiction. The stories are about pimps, prostitutes, street crime, drugs, violence, illicit sex, but it apparently is creating a new breed of reader and a new profit for some of the stodgy publishing houses. Now check out some of the titles, which, you know, are very interesting in themselves. Here's one which is called G-Spot. There's Candy Liquor. There's Thugalicious and A Hustler's Wife. Now, it might raise the eyes on some mainstream publishing houses, but it's the story of street life that a lot of young people want to read. Because I remember, you know, back in the late 70s, early 80s, that stuff when Scruples and all that pre-dynasty, big hair, big money stuff was out, you know, we read that. You didn't necessarily relate to it, but it was good fiction. But what we have now is that a lot of people are realizing they don't have to just read that stuff anymore. They can create their own information. And that's exactly what Sister Soulja did. She wrote a book and it sold a million copies, and it's called The Coldest Winter Ever. And what she did was market her book to her hip-hop audience, and they are like gobbling it up, and people are taking notice of what she did. And just to talk about how that's happening, let's look at 50 Cent has teamed up with MTV Pocket Books to create a series of novellas and graphic novels for a G-Unit Books street fiction series, which is going to debut next year. And that's going to be kind of interesting to see, you know, the stories that come out of it, will it be somewhat different, or will it kind of be the same kind of stuff that we read about all the time? And what Sister Soldier did was she promoted her books to people who weren't really coming to the bookstores, but who wanted to read something, but they wanted to read something that they could relate to, something that they understood. And it's very interesting. And even the Library Journal, which is a library industry publication, has acknowledged the popularity of urban literature. It's something that's shaking people upside down. It's a new way for clients and publishing companies to make money and to really tap into the whole hip-hop culture. It really gets back to what I said in a few podcasts ago, and what Master P said was that marketers and everybody else are taking advantage of the hip-hop culture, but they're not always giving it the props that they should give it. It's just like really, really interesting. Here's another book titled Thugs and the Women Who Love Them, published by a small company. And this person sold plenty of the books from jail because, you know, a lot of ex-cons and cons are signing book contracts and writing them in jail, which is, you know, very interesting. Now, here's another author called Omotosho, who's a professor at Clark Atlanta University in Georgia, who really, he's taken a negative approach to the whole gangster lit phenomenon and saying, you know, it's not really literature. They don't really get into the literary devices such as metaphors and similes. And they're trying to make, basically, he's saying garbage literature. But I think there's a place for everything. And hey, if we have people in jail who realize they have some talent to write and there's an avenue for them to have another career and make some money, why not? Why not? And obviously there's a market for this because as one of the writers said, actually she's an ex-con, her name is Vicky Stringer, and she self-published her first novel called Let That Be the Reason, which really was an inspirational story to help people stay straight and not get caught up in jail. She served like 7 years in prison, 1994 to 2001, for drug trafficking. And in 2002, she founded her hip-hop and urban literature company, Triple Crown Publications, which is based in Columbus, Ohio. She has 9 full-time employees and distributes books throughout the United States. And she said, I remember in prison reading Danielle Steele and saying, yeah, right, after reading the stories, you know, you just can't relate to that. You know, black people love and other minorities love to read, but there aren't always books that kind of tell their stories that they can relate to. And here is a whole another industry that has popped up, which is serving that population. I say great. So it's very interesting. So hip hop has moved into the realm of publishing. Very interesting. Now, let's talk a little bit about Star Jones, because remember in the previous podcast I talked about that white talk show host who called Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice a coon and then was able to land another job, you know, maybe 2 weeks later. But here is Star, who, you know, left The View 2 weeks ago. She did host House Hunters, which is Home and Garden's TV show. But to date, you know, none of the networks or some of the talk arenas have picked her up, you know, have not offered her something. And they're saying that perhaps she's being considered to be, you know, a celebrity judge on some of the reality shows. But, you know, she's been out there a while. She's had her Jones and Jury syndicated show, which lasted one season. And, you know, she began her career as a lawyer, so she's done, you know, lots of TV and been exposed on that. But again, you know, no one has picked her up yet. No one's given her a new gig, a new permanent gig. So it makes you kind of look at that and wonder, and you just kind of wonder what's going to happen with her. Will anybody be brave enough to pick her up, or will people not touch her? Will she kind of fade away? Will she show up on, some kind of infomercial selling something? But it'll just be interesting to see. She's a bright woman, very smart woman, obviously has some talents, but again, no one has picked her up. So it'll be very interesting to see, what happens with Star, and can she lose some of the diva ways and go back to appealing to people that she appealed to in the very beginning, which was, she was heavy at that time so people could relate to her. So now she's got to do an image change, and she's got to come out a little bit nicer. And she's doing that, by making the rounds and talking about why she left, but she probably still has to do a whole makeover in terms of how she's going to reposition herself in the market and position herself in a way that people will be interested in her and will be interested and want to see her in other situations. So, we wish her the best, and I hope she does land on her feet, and I hope she gets something good so that she can thumb her nose at Barbara Walters and say, hey, you didn't ruin my career. I can still do some things on my own. Now let's talk about YouTube, which is 7 months old. It's very interesting because the great people who are doing well on this are like they're in their 20s, which is very interesting. So I can't wait to see if there will be any other people of color who, can take advantage of this and be part of it. But it just goes to show you, with technology coming, it's usually the young folks and the teens who jump on it and figure out ways to use it. And then, we older folk, come on board a little bit later. But I'm going to check it out because it really looks like a lot of fun and looks like some fun things that could be checked out. But anyway, I think I've bent your ear quite enough. We did a little serious stuff at the beginning, and then we got into our usual entertainment kind of information halfway through. But in any event, again, thanks to all my fans around the world who continue to download and who continue to make Digital Sister a success. I thank you, and I will be back to you in a couple of days with some more cultural reflections and discussion. So anyway, have a great week, and I will be back with you in a few days. Take care.